Today we have two parts to our program. We're going to go on a Mayan adventure with 5th and 6th graders at Morse Pond School in Falmouth, where authors John and Pamela Vogel recently paid a visit. But first we sit down with children's author Kate Pfeiffer, who has two new books out, The Wild Wild Inside, A View for Mommy's Tummy, and But I Wanted a Baby Brother. Welcome to the program, Kate.
Hi, Mindy. It's really nice to be here.
And this, you've been doing this for a while now. You've got several books out, and I'm just thinking back to the very first one you had, which was inspired by your daughter's love of the color pink. And I think anybody who has little girls knows that just something in little girls that they are attracted to pink. So I'm wondering, with all the books that have followed, has your subject matter been inspired by real life experiences?
Often it is inspired by real life experiences. I tend to mine my household for material. My first book, Double Pink, as you mentioned, was inspired by my daughter's devotion, true devotion to this color, which presented itself inexplicably. It was I had always prided myself on being a gender color neutralist, but she became attached and very passionate to this color, and inspired the story about a little girl who loves the color pink, perhaps a little bit too much.
All right, let me ask you first before we get into the new books. You've got kind of this pretty eclectic background. So how did you come to write children's books? And it's not as easy as it sounds.
Right. I have to attribute that to moving year-round to Martha's Vineyard and having to create a new career for myself. I had been working in television before that for about 10 years in Boston, and I had a commuter marriage. My husband was living on the vineyard. I was going back and forth between Boston and the vineyard. And then when our daughter was born, I left my job in television and decided to try living on the vineyard year-round, but was left without anything to do because obviously there are no television stations in the vineyard. And so I started writing, and started writing for children. I mean, magazine articles also, but there was all this great material presenting itself.
Right. Well, one of the things, I think a lot of people think, oh, children's book, that must be easy. And it really is not that easy. I mean, you've got to get the language right, and you have a real knack for getting the language right. Is that something you had to study somewhere, or did it just come to you? How did you capture that?
I think I'm very much in touch with my inner 8-year-old or 6-year-old or I'm arrested development. The language, I feel like it's very easy for me to speak on the level of a 5-year-old, a 6-year-old. I enjoy speaking on that level.
All right. So let's talk about The Wild Wild Inside, which basically looks at the question that pregnant women get asked all the time. What's the baby doing?
And that's exactly why I wrote this book. While I was pregnant, I have a multi-generational family. My little sister was 3 years old while I was pregnant with Maddie. And she kept asking me, Katie, what's the baby doing? And if I gave her sort of a rudimentary answer, I think the baby's kicking, she'd look at me and nod her head, and it wasn't acceptable. So I started making up stories, and she constantly wanted to know what adventure the baby was having. And so I would make up story after story, and I realized this was great material for a book. Most of the books, for some reason, this topic is not explored in a lot of books, children's books. A lot of books about pregnant mommies are based in fact. Mm-hmm. And this material seemed ripe. This idea seemed ripe for exploration.
Well, it's really sweet. And I have to tell you my favorite page in here, because when you've got this baby doing all kinds of things, she'll say the baby's, sleeping. It's like, no, I'm off on a rocket ship, exploring. I'm out in the sea. I'm doing this. And when my mom was reading Emily and Gus, A Goodnight Story, and they asked, what's the baby doing? She said, the baby's sleeping. This time she was almost right. I was doing yoga. It had been a busy day and I needed to relax. That's my favorite page. This one is illustrated by, you're going to have to say Laura's last name for me because I'm going to get it wrong.
Huliska Beef.
Yeah. Now, you have sometimes worked with the same illustrator, many times different illustrators. And illustrations, of course, are such an important part of a children's book. So what is that process of you and how you hook up with what illustrator you decide to work with?
Well, I'm a very visual writer. When I'm writing a story, I'm visualizing how it will look. Now, it never looks how I visualize it, of course, because I'm not doing the drawings. But each story presents itself with a style that it would work best with. Mm-hmm. For instance, my book, Henry the Dog with No Tail, was illustrated by my father, who's illustrated many books. But both the story lent itself to him illustrating it, and the fact that he knew the real Henry, the dog with no tail, who is my dog.
I was just going to ask you that. Did Henry really not have a tail?
Henry really doesn't have a tail.
Right. And your father's Jules Pfeiffer, we should mention.
Right. Yeah. And so it seemed natural and obvious that he would illustrate that book.
Yeah. That was a great book, by the way.
Thank you.
My niece has it and she loves it.
Oh, great. Thank you. Tell her to come over and meet the real Henry someday.
Right. Yeah, she would love that. Now, let's move on to But I Wanted a Baby Brother. I'm wondering, is this something that you've been witnessing in real life? Because of this, you know, the kids get this idea in their head. They want a brother, they want a sister, and when it's not what they want.
This was perhaps the only story that I have no real personal connection to. I grew up until the age of 20, an only child. I have an only child.
Right.
This book started, believe it or not, as a sequel to my book, President Pennybaker. And the character Luke Pennybaker was supposed to get a sibling. Well, the President Pennybaker came out before the last presidential election and sadly didn't quite do as well as we had expected it to do. And we realized that it really didn't warrant a sequel. As much as we loved the character, I had to change the story and create these new characters, Oliver Keaton and his dog Chaplin, and the story's much stronger for it. Mm-hmm. But it didn't. This is the only story that really didn't come from within, somewhere from within.
And you know, it's really interesting because you have autobiography of Oliver Keaton in the beginning by Oliver Keaton. My name is Oliver Keaton. My initials are OK. I have one dog. His name is Chaplin. I don't have any sisters, and I don't want a sister. I want a brother. I've wanted a brother for my entire life. My favorite thing to do is ride my bike. I like playing baseball. I know a big secret. No one told me, but I figured it out by looking at my mom. I'm getting a baby brother. I can't wait. No, he gets a baby sister.
And he will tell you by mistake.
Yes. And it's funny because as I was reading this, I have a friend who had a son, who was a boy, and her second child was a daughter. And I don't think it was he wanted a baby brother, but I think he liked being the only child. And when the baby came, it was like, okay, we can send her now to go live with grandma and grandpa. So this is a common thing, wanting to send that baby away somewhere else.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of kids, they get their heart set on their new baby brother, their new baby sister, and then the opposite arrives and, you know, it takes perhaps a while to come to accept and then love it.
Well, again, this is some of the lines in here, I can't remember exactly where it was, but where he finally, you know, he's been searching everywhere to replace this baby sister, wanting to make trades with friends and what have you. And what did he say? He searched for a year and
17 hours.
Yeah, a year and 17. I thought that was very funny. But he comes along that road to appreciate the qualities that his baby sister has, which is a lovely way to end the book, I suppose. I won't give away the total ending, but there is another surprise.
There is a surprise.
He does come to accept his baby sister. We're talking with Kate Pfeiffer, children's book author. Her two new books are The Wild, Wild Inside, A View from Mommy's Tummy, and But I Wanted a Baby Brother. Now, obviously, these books are aimed at children, but I wonder if sometimes you mix in a little message or humor for adults in there.
I certainly try.
Yeah.
I mean, the adults are going to be reading these books to the kids. So if I can get adults laughing and kids laughing, then I've done my job well.
Right. Well, I laughed. There was a couple lines that really struck me that I thought, is she writing that for the kids or is she writing that for the parents?
I also find the illustrations, Diane Good, the brilliant Diane Good's illustrations in all her books, but particularly in this book, are so hilarious. Mm-hmm. And there's a double spread of Oliver and his dog Chaplin going into a place that had assigned change babies here.
Oh, right.
Where they're expecting to change their baby sister for a baby brother, but of course it's a changing room, and it's just a double spread that's absolutely hilarious.
It is very funny. And you know, that's one of those ones I went, you know, you can see that from a child's going, change babies here, of course, and then of course the humor for the adults, so you're kind of accomplishing two things there with that. Now, you've worked with Diane before.
We have done now three books together.
What were the other two that you did with Diane?
We did My Mother's Trying to Ruin My Life and President Pennybaker. Okay.
My Mother's Trying to Ruin My Life, that was based on a true incident, right?
That is based on, yes, sadly. I have, it turns out, become an embarrassment to my daughter.
It happens when they get to a certain age.
So I do all those embarrassing things that moms do. I kiss her in public. I talk too loudly. And I tell her, as I think many mothers do, well, that's my job to embarrass you. And my mom is trying to ruin my life was indeed, you know, based on a true story and, you know, a true incident that occurred. I wrote the book very quickly, and it seems to resonate with kids.
Yeah. So you're obviously having fun with this.
I love it. I love every part of it.
So let me ask you, going back to the first book, getting published, because, you know, once you've been published and you've got some success, it's much easier, as you know. But in the beginning, when you had Double Pink and you're going around, was it tough, or did you find it not too hard to get published to begin with?
I was very lucky. It didn't take terribly long. I had a few rejections, but I was incredibly lucky that my manuscript landed in my editor, the editor who published it's lap, who I've done all these other books with as well. We connected. She connected with the story. We connected. It's been a wonderful working relationship.
There's a lot of competition, though, in children's books.
I know. I panic every time I go into a bookstore.
And, you know, we were talking on the phone the other day, and this is something I had not really thought about, but you said recession seems to be hurting children's book sales. And I was really surprised to hear that, because I you know, you think of the internet and Kindle and all these things, and I understand that may, you know, hurt adult book sales, but I always thought kids' books, you know, you like the kids up in your lap, you've got the book, you've got the pictures. I guess it's just a cost factor.
I guess, I mean, conventional wisdom was people would always buy books for their kids. If, you know, no matter what, they would buy books for their kids. Maybe it's cost, maybe it's new media. I have a theory. Do you want to hear?
Yes,
do you want
I
me
do.
To get on my soapbox?
Yes, what's your theory?
Okay, my theory is that a lot of parents are trying to graduate their children onto chapter books very quickly, that for some reason they think it's prestigious, or their child is especially smart if they can say, well, they're 6 years old and they're already reading chapter books. So in fact, if you're going to spend whatever it costs, $17 on a book, and it's going to last a year instead of 3 or 4 years, it's not quite worth it anymore. Now, I would argue, and I do argue to anyone who will listen, that there is a real need to continue, even the children who are reading Moby Dick at the age of 8, for them to continue reading picture books. There is so much that can be gained from these books.
And again, even just like from an adult perspective, the artwork that goes into these books.
It's
and as we think back to our own childhoods and the books that stand out in our memories, I know I have a collection of old children's books that I every once in a while have to pick up and look at again. And the illustrations, again, are just so, I mean, worth it for themselves there. And those memories, it kind of, you know, you get to walk back down memory lane and then share it with your next generation, you know, which is always a good thing. So how many books a year do you do?
It depends. The last few years I've had sort of quite a few published. Last year I had 3 published last spring. This spring I've had 2 books published. Next spring I'll have 1 book published. I'm working backwards.
So are you any plans to venture out into books for a little bit older, or are you happy with this age group?
Well, I did write 1 chapter book, and it's sort of a hybrid book where it is chapters, but it is loaded with illustrations. So it's for the kids who don't want to give up, you know, illustrations, but want more words.
Right. That's great. And now you have got 2 book signings coming up. July 17th, you're going to be at 8 Cousins, 11 a.m.
Right.
And you're going to be there with another?
Colleen Parator, and we're going to have a kid-lit scavenger hunt.
Oh, that sounds like fun. And then the Brewster Bookstore, July 20th, 10 a.m.?
10 a.m., also with Colleen, and we'll have a lot of fun there as well.
All right. The books are But I Wanted a Baby Brother and The Wild, Wild Inside, A View from Mommy's Tummy. Kate Pfeiffer, so nice to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much, Mindy. This was great fun.
John and Pamela Vogel are a husband-wife team who have written the trilogy Middle World. Book one is The Jaguar Stones. 14-year-old Max Murphy, video gamer extraordinaire, is furious when his archaeologist parents canceled the family vacation to go on a dig in Central America. But things go from bad to worse when Max is summoned to join them, only to discover that his parents have vanished. With the help of Lola, a fast-talking, quick-thinking Maya girl, Max embarks on a quest to find out just what's going on. Soon, Max and Lola are running for their lives in the perilous rainforest as they unlock ancient secrets, meet mysterious strangers, and begin to understand that in San Xavier, nothing is ever as it seems. The storyline may be fiction, but the facts on the Mayan history and culture are based in reality.
The vocals dressed in safari gear arrive at Morse Pond School in Falmouth to take 5th and 6th graders on a pretend tour to the rainforest of Central America.
Well, hello! Well, that was pretty good, but I think you can do better than that. Hello! Hello! My name's John. This is Kamala.
Hello.
So today, we're going to give you a taste of the world of the Maya that inspired the Jaguar Stones trilogy, and show you some of the tastes, sights, and sounds of the rainforest in which they live. So we're going to leave Falmouth far behind us, and we're going to take you with us to the hot and steamy jungles of Central America. Are you ready?
Yeah!
Oh, you don't sound very ready. Are you ready?
Yeah!
Much better. Okay, fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy ride.
It does rain a lot in the rainforest, but not continuously. Let me tell you the answer. Just look up. If you've got the canopy of trees over your head, you're in the rainforest. If you can see the sky, you're in the jungle. Now, that means that the canopy of trees in the rainforest is blocking out the light from the forest floor, so not very much is growing down there, and it's very easy to just walk through a rainforest. Whereas in the jungle, everything's still growing up from the forest floor, so you have to hack your way through with a machete.
Let me see if I got that right. So if it was rainy in the rainforest, the rain would hit the canopy above, and it would take a while for the rain to work its way through the leaves to the forest floor below. But if you were in the jungle, you wouldn't have that canopy of trees above you. So the rain would come straight down.
As you would get wet in the jungle during a rainstorm, our students experienced the showers from John's spray bottle. The mealworms were not that appetizing to everyone, but some kids couldn't get enough.
Pretty good.
Yeah, awesome.
The students learn a bit about Maya culture, the environment, and the animals who live in the rainforest, including some lessons on how to imitate spider and howler monkeys.
Wow, if anybody can give me a howler monkey, do it now. Give me a howler monkey if you got one.
The big finish included a surprise visit from a Mayan chief, which turned out to be a teacher in a very elaborate costume. He left the students with some words of wisdom.
Read the book.
Worked in advertising and, in fact, had your own agency in London, which you're both partners in. So how did you get from advertising to writing books for school kids?
Well, it was quite unexpected. We originally, when we moved to America, the plan was for me to teach at the Tuck Business School at Dartmouth College. And my plan was to write a marketing book. I was going to do consultancy work with the agency back in London and then do some teaching as well. And I sat down to write the marketing book, and I had all the research, and I was sitting down to write it, and, you know, I just couldn't do it. It just seemed, I'd been doing advertising for so long, it seemed so boring. And I thought to myself, you know what I'd rather do is I would tell the kids bedtime stories. And my son had a favorite bedtime story, which was about him and the monkey girl and these Maya pyramids. And I thought, you know, that would make such a great and fun book. So I took that with a combination of my experience of growing up in South America. And that's where we wrote the first version of the book. And it was quite a thing coming to my palm and saying, you know, plan, we moved, I brought you to America, and the whole plan's changed. We're going to write a kid's book now. And I think she took pretty well.
Well, and so how does this work, Pam? It's a joint effort. So do you write together, take turns? Who does what?
We talk about the story together, and we plot out the story endlessly, and then I do most of the actual writing and John does the illustrating, but we talk about the characters constantly like the members of the family. You know, it's like they're in the room with us all the time. We talk about them.
And this is a family adventure in a sense that a lot of the research, you've dragged your kids along to some pretty exotic locations as well. So do they get input into the story, or they just come along for the ride?
Well, in two ways. I think they come along for a ride, but we're also trying to put them into situations and see how kids react to things. So we're looking for what their reaction to things are. I think we probably make them suffer a little bit more than they need to really get the full experience, because one of the most important things about going down there is to make sure that we have a sense of reality so that we can bring real experience to alive in the book. We couldn't write about it unless we experienced it, and particularly to see the pyramids, underground rivers, howler monkeys through the eyes of the kids really helps us able to communicate that to the kids that are reading the book.
But our kids, all kids, I think they're really brave. They're much braver than I am. I'm scared of everything, but the kids will just climb every pyramid and not even think about it. And some of these steps are like, you know, 4 inches wide. And
John, you grew up in Peru, Costa Rica, and Colombia, so I'm assuming that's where your interest in the rainforest comes from. Is that correct?
Well, it's actually the opposite, in that I hated growing up in South America because I wanted to play in a rock band in a city, and my parents were dragging me through one miserable little town after another, so I couldn't wait to get out. But when we started writing the books, and it was Pamela who said, you know, I've got to go down there. And so the first time I had been back was when we both went together. And so we climbed pyramids, we did all the things, and it's in this coming back as an adult where I've really grown to start to really love Central and South America. So it's a very different experience than I had when I was a kid. I think when you're there by choice rather than not by choice, I think makes all the difference.
And also we stay in nice hotels.
Now, the story, of course, is fiction, as is the country of San Xavier, but the details about the Maya based in fact.
Yes, everything is checked by an archaeologist at Harvard to make sure that we have our facts straight, because the Maya have really suffered, I think, from a lack of knowledge. Like we were telling the children, that all their books were burned, and then it was easy to make them out as some kind of ignorant savages, and then in history since then they've been very oppressed. And the more Maya people that we've met, the more we've wanted to tell their story. And in fact, shall I tell you something that happened? That we were at a Maya site called Yashar in Guatemala. And I think it was a day when Maya people, when local people got in free, because we were actually the only gringos there. Everyone else was Maya, so they're all looking at us anyway. And our son Harry is 6'6", which is about a good foot taller than the tallest of the Guatemalan teenagers. So we attracted a bit of an entourage, and they were following us around, and they started talking to Harry in Spanish, and they started taking his photograph and posing with him. And he became the tourist attraction at this site instead of all these amazing old pyramids that were just being excavated. And we were with a Guatemalan guide, and he'd been watching all this. And suddenly he kind of went a bit pink, and he stepped forward. And obviously this is all in Spanish. And he said, yes, remember these people, take their picture, but not because their son is tall. Remember them because they've written a book about Maya culture. And thanks to them, children in North America will be reading about you and your history. And then all these gum-chewing Guatemalan kids, they just suddenly burst into applause with these pyramids behind them. And I was just, that changes everything. We have to get it right. We owe it to these kids. If we're going to tell their story, we're going to get everything right and make them proud of us, you know. So if we ever go back, if it ever gets translated into Spanish, they're going to go, those gringos did a good job.
They got it right. Let me ask you, because there's all this talk about the Mayan calendar and the end of the world in 2012, and I'm sure a lot of kids ask about that. A lot of kids are afraid of that, and you say, not happening.
Yes, that's one of the first questions that we get everywhere we go, and films like 2012 have really scared kids, and I think a lot of people on the internet and films are using the uncertainty about that to really stir it up. And the real, I think the best piece of evidence I can give you to say that the Maya calendar isn't ending is in Palenque at the Temple of Inscriptions. In the tomb of King Pakal is the longest intact inscription ever discovered, and it's about the history of Palenque and particularly about the role of King Pakal. And in it is a place where it says his coronation will be remembered, and the date that they give that we will still be talking about Pakal is the date in our calendar, which is the year 4700 or something like that. So it was very clear that the Maya in Palenque had no expectation that the calendar would end or that there would be the end of world. And in fact, there is no general cultural concept of cataclysm in Maya thinking. Their belief of time was a recurring series of cycles. And while in December 2012 is the beginning of a new 400-year period, much the way the change of millennium would be seen with certain undertones of the creation, they certainly have a big party, but they would have never thought it was the end of the world.
So besides the adventures to these countries and looking, what's involved in the research?
We've read a lot of books. There's always a new book to read about the Maya. As I said in the presentation, they're still discovering. They make new discoveries all the time, and we try and keep abreast of that. There's actually a great exhibition on at the Peabody Salem at the moment, The Maya and the Mythic Sea, which we've been hanging out at a lot.
And we've been visiting Maya sites. What's extraordinary about Maya sites is that every city's architecture is completely different, so that the more sites you go to, the more sort of experience you get. So we've been to 30 different Maya sites so far. I took a course at the Peabody Museum at Harvard to learn how to read and write Maya glyphs, because it became part of the obsession to know everything that we could possibly about it. And that's where we met Dr. Mark Zender, who is the guy who checks through all our facts, makes sure that my glyph spelling is correct. And
now, this book, this first, The Jaguar Stones, Book One, Middle World, you have three, right? The trilogy. Are you just planning the three, or are you planning to go beyond that?
We're planning three books. Book two is with the publishers now. That will be out at the end of the year. Book three is still in the writing process, although I've written the very last paragraph, so I know exactly where we're headed. I know how the series ends.
And what will you do from there, or have you thought that far?
I haven't thought that far. My head is so full of the Maya and the rainforest, and I can't imagine them not being in our lives anymore, though.
I'm sure you'll find another adventure. John and Pamela Vogel, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. Yes.
Lovely to talk to you.
Thanks to Brian Morris, who recorded and edited our visit to Morse Pond School. I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
Hosted and produced by Mindy Todd. The executive producer is Steve Young. Production assistance from Dan Treidel and Jenny Jenker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH Radio.